Good afternoon. It's 2:59 p.m. and time for another edition of A Juno Afternoon. I'm Ken Fix. I'll be your host for today. On the show, we'll be talking with Nate Valier. He'll be here to highlight this year's Rally for Life. And we'll talk to Donna Pierce about the new Valley Library. We'll get an update on Eagle Crest with Julie Jackson and Matt Lillard. School Superintendent Mark Miller will be here to talk about the new elementary language arts curriculum. These guests, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and lots more for Tuesday, November 25th, 2014. Stay tuned. National Native News is up first.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canadian officials say a massive dam break has not had major impacts on traditional fishing grounds downstream, but some First Nations group worry similar incidents could happen elsewhere. Ed Schoenfeld reports.
A dam at eastern British Columbia's Mount Polly mine breached last summer. More than 2 billion gallons of water and slurry were released into nearby streams and lakes. Tribal groups called First Nations in Canada worried released chemicals and minerals would damage salmon runs far downstream. But British Columbia Mines Minister Bill Bennett says tests so far show water and fish to be safe.
We're going to have to measure the impact in terms of long-term, obviously, but so far we've been sampling fish tissues and sampling sediment and sampling water, and so far so good.
First Nations groups aren't satisfied with those tests. The Union of British Columbia Indian Chiefs has called for more extensive research into the impacts. Meanwhile, Mount Polly's owners are close to opening another mine. This one is in eastern British Columbia, near the salmon-producing Stikine River. Bennett says that won't happen till he's sure it's safe.
We've actually paid for the Tahltan First Nation to hire an expert to advise them, so their expert has to be satisfied before we're going to let that mine open.
The Tahltans are the First Nation closest to that mine. For National Native News, I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The second of 5 years' work has been completed on the passage of wind and water sculpture in Rapid City, South Dakota. As Jim Kent reports, the finished art piece will reflect the archaeological, geological, and cultural history of the Badlands and the Black Hills.
The passage of wind and water sculpture will consist of the Badlands Stone Tapestry Garden and the Black Hills Stone Tapestry Garden. Sculptor Masayuki Nagase spent last year carving images to reflect the ancient history of the Badlands. His goal this year was to create images to reflect the various conflicts and tragedies suffered by Native Americans in this area. But at the same time, he didn't want to immerse himself or the viewer in negativity.
To express sort of prayer for me, to bring people to life, not dying, but it keeps going. And live with this transformation and the change in history.
Yuki Nagase created images of lightning bolts and tree roots to symbolize the destruction and continued life of the Native culture. Although Yuki has greeted countless visitors since he began the project, this past summer saw many Lakota people stopping by.
And they all talked straight how they felt. And I was very happy, actually, because you know, many people come and visit and talk to me, but quite a few people talk about more technical things. They never talk about how they feel.
As Masayuki Nagase returns to his home in California, he hopes his sculpture will provide an opportunity for anyone who views it to think about the past and contemplate the future. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
President Obama honored Native American writer, curator, and advocate Suzanne Schoen Harjo Monday.
She has helped preserve 1 million acres of Indian land, helped develop laws preserving tribal sovereignty. She's repatriated sacred cultural items to tribes while expanding museums that celebrate Native life. Because of Suzanne, more young Native Americans are growing up with pride in their heritage and with faith in their future. And she's taught all of us that Native values make Americans stronger.
Harjo was among more than a dozen people to receive the Medal of Freedom at a White House ceremony. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes to Albuquerque the Striking Eagle Invitational Basketball Tournament and Educational Fair on December 31st. Information on services and the fair at ahcnm.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Our first guest on the show is in the studio today. He's Nate Valier, and he's going to be talking about the Relay for Life, and he's the organizer for it here in Juneau. Welcome, Nate, to the show. Thanks. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Actually, they've done some changes, and I'm one of three organizers. So instead of having one person oversee the whole organization and the whole committee, what they've allowed us to do is give us a lot more freedom this year. And so we split the duties up into three individuals, and then from there we kind of farm out. And I think it'll give us a much better event here in Juneau than we've seen in previous years, and as long as the rain stays away. So anything we can do to do that, because we've had some amazing Junes where, you know, we've had a relay without a drop of rain, and I guess last year it almost became a tsunami. You know, people were walking the track at night, and tents were filling up with water, and amazingly, people still walked. You know, and that's part of the whole mission statement with the Cancer Society is, you know, cancer never sleeps. And our Juneau participants came out in full force last year, raised a lot of money, had a good event, and hopefully this year we, you know, can avoid the rain again and have a more fun, more interactive event.
Nate, where and how did the Relay for Life start?
Well, it actually started in Tacoma, Washington, in the early 80s by Dr. Gordon Platt, and he decided to raise money by simply walking around a track for 24 hours. Didn't sleep, didn't take any lunch breaks, and raised a significant amount of money. And then the next year, a lot of people at the hospital joined him, and that's how the Relay for Life became a fundraising event. And now it is the fundraiser for the American Cancer Society, with thousands of events held every year around the world.
Nate, what's the mission of the Relay for Life?
Well, the Relay for Life, what they try to do is, and this is an issue that affects a lot of not-for-profits, or it's hard to raise money, and it's hard to get into a specific demographic. And with the Relay for Life, it's able to branch out to younger kids. You know, we had one of the, I believe, a Montessori school a year or two ago. You know, their kids did a Relay recess where they talked about cancer. They did little events and fundraisers at school. They did some laps at around the track. It involves middle-aged folks. It involves, like, the high school. They've gotten involved before helping us out, and even the older citizens. Because, you know, when you're in your late 20s, early 30s, you don't think about cancer. You think about grandma getting, you know, breast cancer. You don't realize that it affects people of every age. And so with Relay for Life, it's a fundraiser where it can encapsulate all age groups to come together to help fight cancer, because you never know when cancer is going to creep up.
All true. Yeah. And how many years has this been going on here in Juneau?
I believe we're going on our, I think it's either 16 or 17 years, I believe. And it's been going on, 16 or 17 years. And we typically get anywhere from 40 teams to 50 teams and raise. It's been a variance of between $65,000 and $100,000. I mean, the community really steps up to this event.
Okay. What are the features of the Relay for Life?
Well, the main one is, of course, the track. You know, we use Riverbend Elementary at the ballpark, so people walk around the track, or someone from your team should be on the track for at least a 24-hour period. Because we're a tourist town, we've recognized that, so we're only going to be doing it for 18 hours this year. So we're going to go from 6 p.m. to noon the next day. Sorry about that. And with that, we try to have an event that goes along with it. So there's, of course, a survivor's lap. So if you've, you know, beaten cancer and you've survived it, what we do is we have a recognition walk and lap for you. You'll get a T-shirt. We give you a dinner as well, and we give you some recognition with that. At midnight, we try to do a luminaria ceremony where you know, even if you've survived or lost someone to the battle, you can decorate a white bag. We'll place it around the track at night. We'll either put a candle or some kind of little flickering light inside, and we weigh it down, you know, depending on the weather. And it's just a very beautiful ceremony because as you walk around the track, you see everybody's names on these and the amount of time people put into this to remember those who weren't successful at fighting cancer. And that ceremony goes for about an hour. We try to do games in between to keep people going because at 3 in the morning and you're walking the track, it's there's not a lot to do. So we try to have events going on such as a penny toss. We'll do like Bark for Life where you can bring your dog. For like an hour, you can dress up like your dog and walk around the track. And it's kind of cool to see, especially some of the local Juno talent come out because there's some amazing seamstresses out there and people who just really go all out with that. So we're gonna go on some of the successes we've had with that. We've had some food vendors come out as well and bring out some interesting items to eat. And some of the teams will do fundraisers like Core will do like a Krispy Kreme fundraiser. And so they'll have donuts out there for people to come out and pick up. We try to do some bands, but the problem we see with that is the limited audience because we know some people may not like a particular music. So, and that's always been a challenge in this town. There's never a shortage of talent, but what we're going to try to do this year is balance everything and try to have a more hearty event, I guess is the right word to use.
How can people get involved if they want to participate? Walk in the track or get involved sponsoring somebody who is?
Well, what we have a website, which is simply relayforlifeofjuno.org. There's some information on there, such as how to sign up or join a team. And you don't necessarily have to have a team. You know, for instance, Temsco has been an amazing sponsor of relays in the past, but they can't really dedicate a lot of resources and time to it because relay happens on the first week of June, and there's always a lot of cruise ships in port. So what we're going to try to do this year is offer virtual teams where people can still participate. Like we have Gallery Walk coming up in the Senate building. You know, three teams came together, and we're going to have a storefront to help educate people about cancer, everything the Cancer Society does for folks here in Alaska, because that's a big point, is people don't realize the money we raise does help locally. It just doesn't go to some scientist in a lab in Washington or San Francisco. And so we're trying to do more outreach for the teams and get more involvement in the and as a community because you don't necessarily have to give up all your time, you know, in June come out to the track. We'd like to see you there. But the whole mission statement is, of course, you know, raising money to fight cancer. And so, of course, it's relayforlifeofjuno.org. We're going to be around town quite a bit. We'll have meetings once a month. We'll update our Facebook page. You can just simply search for Juno Relay on Facebook. And so we normally have a lot of pictures up there. The website stays updated. And, of course, there's no cost. You know, the whole idea here is to help raise money as well as educate Juno about what the Cancer Society can do for people here in town, especially when you get affected by cancer. It's just it's such a huge shock. People don't realize the money that we raise here helps that. You know, I mean, cancer.org is funded by the Cancer Society. They help pay for travel. They help pay for doctors and wigs. There's just so much that the ACS does to raise money and help disperse that locally. And so we don't want people to think that it's just limited to research. I mean, it'd be great to, you know, find a cure for cancer. But there's so many cancer groups out there as well that, you know, and that's one of the challenges we have and why we try to make this event an all-encompassing event for everybody to come. So this way you can come out, bring your kids, bring your dog, you know, even, I'm not sure if you want to bring your cat, but... But it should be a fun event this year.
Okay, and it's not happening just yet, is it? When is this going to take place?
Right, well, right now we've got it scheduled for June 5th out at Riverbend Elementary School. And we have events going on between now and then. So, like, this weekend, we'll be at, a team will be out at Nugget Mall with the Santa's Garage Sale. We'll be at the public market. You know, there'll be some tables out there. So just look for the purple. You know, talk to anybody, you know, if you see them wearing the Relay for Life or the Cancer Society logos and get involved.
Okay. Nate Belliere, thank you very much for being our first guest on the show today.
Great. Thanks. Thank you.
It's holiday auction time at KTOO. Starting November 28th, you can do all of your pre-bidding online at ktoo.org. Pre-bidding will end on December 5th, and on December 6th, we'll broadcast on KTOO and KRNN from 8 to 12 for your final chance at fabulous auction items from 10th Street Christmas trees, Alaska Laundry and Cleaners, Gold Belt Mount Roberts Tram, and many more. Don't be left out. Mark your calendar for the KTOO holiday auction starting November 28th. Details at ktoo.org.
It's 3:17. You're listening to KTOO, and a Juno Afternoon continues with my next guests, Barbara Berg and Robert Barr, and they are going to be talking about the New Valley Library fundraiser. Welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the fundraiser here. It says bricks. So let's talk about bricks.
Well, they're going to be engraved bricks with whatever people want to have say, and they'll be on two of the entrance walls of the new facility. So it's a way for people to memorialize family, friends, pets, quips,
okay.
Literary quips, if they can fit it in the space.
And how is the new construction coming along?
It's good. So if you've driven down Riverside Drive recently, you've probably seen the steel going up and the roof going on the new library, which is right next to the pool in Diamond Park. We're hoping to have a shell on the entire building within about a month before the really bad weather starts, and construction should wrap up towards the end of August of next year, and then we'll start the hard job of moving all
everything,
the books,
right? Yeah, from then and home all.
Yeah.
All right, and is there a reason why we went to a new library? Is there one overriding reason why we decided to build a separate building rather than leave it where it was?
So the big one is cost. We spend quite a bit of money right now in rent for the Mendenhall Mall space. And with this new facility, we're going to be able to double the size of the library space that serves the Mendenhall Valley at the same price that we're paying right now. And we'll have a building that we actually own, and we'll be able to control cost increases a lot more than we're able to control rent increases right now. So that's a big one. And of course, not secondary to that really is that the Valley is our most populous area in Juneau and really has been underserved in terms of library space per square foot of the per capita of the population for many, many years. And it's a long time coming. You know, the Friends of the Library run the amazing bookstore and the airport shopping mall, and they've been selling books for a quarter, a dime, a dollar for decades now with the goal of this new facility coming to the Valley.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite places is the bookstore.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I've got too many pounds of books already. But all right, as far as the fundraiser goes, what kind of figure are we looking for as far as the fundraiser? What are you hoping to raise?
So we can sell as many as 1,200 bricks. And the bricks cost either $100 per brick for one line of engraving or $150 for two lines of engraving. And we hope to raise right around $100,000, but we'll do what we get. We have to be done selling by the end of the year. December 31st is our last day to accept any orders, because we need to get our list of engravings off to the engraver so that the bricks can arrive in time to be installed.
Are these going to be regular size bricks that you would see in a building, or are they different sizes or larger, smaller?
They're the same size as the other bricks that will be on the facing of the building. The difference will be that these will have the engraving in them. Yeah. It's a really nice, dark surfaced, glossy, unique looking brick. It's not a conventional looking brick, but it's sort of similar to the siding that they're putting on the new state library.
And the technical, I learned this as part of the construction piece, that they're called face bricks, and they're about a foot long, and they're about four and a half inches tall. And so the engraving goes on the face of the brick, and you can fit 16 characters per line on that brick. They're a little bit longer than a conventional brick.
And people who have been in the downtown library will have noticed the engraved tiles on the floor. We did a similar fundraiser when we built the downtown library in 1989. And people have really enjoyed having their names or their children's names and come back to look them up there. And this would be the same kind of opportunity for people to put a memorial on a building that's going to be there beyond all of our lifetimes.
Yeah.
Building for the future.
Well, and one of the things that we hear at the downtown library across the desk every week is, I really like those tiles. Can I buy one? Can I put one in? And unfortunately, once it's done, it's done. There's no going back. So we're really trying to get the word out, and anyone who wants to buy one can buy one now, because the last thing we want to get is a bunch of people coming afterwards and saying, "Oh, I wish I would have known. I would have bought a brick." That's one reason why we're here.
All right. And the basic cost, again, was $100 per brick?
Yep, $100 for one line. Or if you have a longer thing that you want to say, whether it's, again, a family name or kids or grandkids, pets, business names are great. It's a great way to advertise your business for in perpetuity, really. $100 for one line or $150 for two lines, and it's 16 characters per line. And so the character includes spaces and punctuation and all that stuff, too.
And anybody that wants to purchase a brick, how would they go about doing that?
There are forms at all the libraries, and there's the Friends of the Library website has a link out to that, and their Facebook page has a link. And there will be members of the Friends of the Library at the community market after Thanksgiving in a booth selling bricks.
And that's this weekend.
This weekend, coming up. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that is going to be right across the way here, isn't it?
Right.
It's Centennial Hall.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But probably the easiest way, if your listeners want to order with a credit card, the Friends website is friendsjpl, for Juneau Public Libraries, friendsjpl.org, and there's a link right there.
Is there any special features coming up with the new library that you'd want to tell everybody about? Are we going to have something really cool in there?
It's going to be a
lot. Okay, Barbara, tell me a little bit.
Well, right now we only have the one meeting room in the valley.
Right.
There's going to be a big public meeting room that will be possible to use after regular library hours, have access from the outside without entering the library. Lots of small study rooms so that we can accommodate more private group needs at the same time. There'll be a wonderful teen room, a wonderful children's room, and you want to go on?
Lots of fun technology. we get tons of use at our public computers and Wi-Fi, and so those things are expanding. I've been promising people that we'll be installing a 3D printer in there. I get lots of questions about that, believe it or not. There's lots of interest in our community, people having design stuff that they'd like to print in 3D. So we will hopefully be having a 3D printer right next to our 2D printer. That's a common trend in libraries right now. And there will be a really great reading area. Our architects have done a fabulous job with designing just a really great community gathering space for the Valley, where we really see it as the community center for the Valley. And really Diamond Park as a whole is turning into that, we think.
Very good. All right. Barbara Berg, Robert Barr, thank you for being our guests on the show, and good luck with the fundraiser. Anybody that wants to buy a brick. And you guys need to get out there and, at the fair this weekend, and people just need to pony up, and you get the brick there for all time.
That's right.
You do. Yep.
Or probably at least a couple hundred years. I don't know when we'll need another library.
I think so. That sounds good.
All right. Thank you very much for being our guests on the show.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 25th of November, 2014. It's the birthday of Andrew Carnegie, born in Dunfermline, Scotland, 1835. Grew up poor, worked as a mill hand, came to this country when he was 13, went into the steel business, helped to build the American steel industry, and became one of the richest entrepreneurs of his time. Andrew Carnegie was afraid that the pursuit of wealth would degrade him. So he sold his steel business and gave his fortune away. He endowed 2,811 libraries, he established the Carnegie Endowment, and he bought more than 7,000 organs for churches to, in his words, lessen the pain of the sermons. It's the birthday of Joe DiMaggio, born Martinez, California, 1914, who hit safely in 56 consecutive games in 1941, one of the great feats in the history of baseball. It's the birthday of Helen Hooven Santmeyer, Cincinnati, 1895, grew up in a little town of Xenia, Ohio, went off to New York. She was a secretary for Scribner's Magazine, then moved back to Xenia. She wrote an epic novel about a small-town women's group based on her own women's club of Xenia, Ohio. The book was called And Ladies of the Club. It came out when she was 87 years old, Helen Hooven Santmeyer. It was more than 1,300 pages long, and it went straight to number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And it's the birthday of the physician and essayist Lewis Thomas, born Flushing, New York, 1913. Went to Princeton to study biology and also poetry. He loved the poetry of Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot. Had a big career, became president of the Sloan Kettering Institute, and also started writing informal essays. He wrote them late at night, without an outline, wrote quickly, including no reference notes at the end, writing about the human body, but also philosophy. In 1974, 29 of the essays were collected in The Lives of a Cell, which won the National Book Award. Lewis Thomas, the physician who said, "The great secret of doctors, known only to their wives, but still hidden from the public, is that most things get better by themselves. Most things, in fact, are better in the morning." Here's a poem for today by Sue Ellen Thompson entitled Home. The place your parents brought you straight from the hospital where you spent those endless years of grade school. Or maybe it's the place where you raised your own children, where you were never alone. The place you retreat to after the divorce or when circumstances force you to go there. According to Frost, they have to, but you know the rest. Who can say for how many weeks after moving you will lie awake staring at the clock radio before you stop listening for the pre-dawn roar of traffic down your former street, before the word begins to rise from deep inside somewhere as you approach the yellow blinker at Main and Oak, which, like the porch light your mother flicked off and on when you and your first lover were parked at the darkest edge of the lawn, reminds you where you belong. Home, a poem by Sue Ellen Thompson, from her collection titled They, published by Turning Point Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
I'm Bill Legere, manager of KTOO. The success of this station depends directly on membership support from listeners like you. You can become a member today for as little as $5 a month. Find out more at ktoo.org.
3:31 p.m. You're listening to KTOO in Juneau. And tonight, from 6:30 to 7:30 at the Marie Drake Planetarium, there'll be a presentation called Stars and Why Our Sun Seems So Ordinary. It will cover the birth and death of stars, how we determine what stars are made of, and our nearest stellar neighbors. This will be my last presentation at the Marie Drake Planetarium, as I'm stepping aside to make way for some other volunteers to come in and do some programming. So again, that's tonight from 6:30 to 7:30 at the Marie Drake Planetarium. For those coming from the valley, you just take Glacier Highway, make the left turn where the breakwater is, make the very first right, go past the athletic fences, and as soon as those fences stop, there'll be a walkway on the right-hand side that leads you into the middle school building where the planetarium is located. And if you went past the Blockbuster video, you went too far. So again, tonight from 6:30 to 7:30, Stars and Why Our Sun Seems So Ordinary, and I'll be right back with my next guests. That was Kim Wilde with One. That's from the Wild Winter Songbook. I hope to be playing some more songs from that in the next couple of weeks as we get into the holidays. My next guests in the studio are Superintendent Mark Miller and Ted Wilson. They are going to be here to talk about a few things, the new elementary language arts curriculum. And first off, though, Mark wants to talk about the budget.
You know, I know this is hard to believe. We are actually trying to figure out what our budget is going to be for next year when the kids start in August. We actually have to start our budget preparation now to do that. And unfortunately, for the third or fourth year in a row, we're looking at really deep cuts in our school budget and programs that we serve. Some really, really difficult decisions coming up. We're looking at probably two. Right now, our projection is a $2.5 million shortfall next year. Some really difficult decisions have to be made about what programs do we keep, what programs do we have to cut back, and potentially what programs do we have to lose altogether. We want to get the community's input on that as soon as we can. So we have a meeting scheduled for December 2nd from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Thunder Mountain High School Library. We will present our mission and goals in our preliminary budget, the big picture, which includes right now a $2.5 million shortfall. And then we want to hear from the people. We want to hear from the public. Bring us any idea you have about how we can either increase revenue, programs that you think we could do without, programs that you think could be done differently. I believe that the more people we have inputting into this process, the more conversations we have, the better our decision is going to be in the end. So this is just a call out and a shout out. Everybody out there, we need your help to figure out what this budget is going to look like next year. We've already cut all the fat. Now we're down to bone, and there's going to be some really, really hard decisions that we have to make as an institution. So just asking the public for their help and their input. December 2nd, that's Tuesday, 6 to 8 o'clock at the Thunder Mountain High School Library. Thank you.
Okay, Mark and Ted, have either of you come up with any preliminary ideas for budget cutting? I see some looks that you're not willing to just jump out there and say what they are.
Well, we've, as an administrative team, we've been looking at, inventorying what we have, talking about what would be potential revenue sources to increase revenue. We've looked at what we've already cut that we might really be missing and would want to bring back, and then at the same time look at things that potentially we could reduce. But at this point in time, as far as the administrative team is concerned, it's the beginning of trying to inventory where we're at with those things, knowing that last year, being in that process, we felt like we had already cut beyond what we felt we could cut.
And let's be honest, $9 out of every 10 that we get goes to people. And so there is not enough dollar in the budget to avoid personnel reductions at some level at some point. You can't save $2.5 million in an organization that spends 9 out of every $10 on people without reducing the number of people. These are really hard decisions that we have to make, but we understand that that less people, if the budget stays the way it is the only way we're going to solve this problem.
Okay. Mark, is there any physical property that the school district has that they can sell?
There certainly isn't any that I'm aware of. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we need to do right now, and I heard you speaking on your public spot beforehand, you know what Marie Drake looks like.
Oh, yeah. We operate on nickels and dimes.
that planetarium is not exactly state-of-the-art, and neither is that school. And that is housing two of our primary alternative programs, our Montessori, which we're looking at expanding, and our alternative school for students who are struggling and really need that education to be able to contribute to society when they graduate in a couple of years. So we have some major capital improvement issues that we're having to work with. So I am not aware of any properties that we could actually sell.
All right, Mark. Moving on to another item here. There's four controversial texts in the fourth grade curriculum that some individuals and organizations in the Alaska Native community want removed from the classroom. Have you read the challenge text? And if so, what's your opinion on that?
I have read the challenge text. And they were written as historical fiction. And they are, in my opinion, I think, and everybody would agree, a lot more fiction than they are historical. And historical fiction is kind of its own unique genre. I think a lot of us know Gone with the Wind, for example. There wasn't really a Rhett Butler, who said, frankly, my dear, well, I won't go there because you're a
lady. Yeah, I know. That's
yeah,
right.
All right.
Scarlet, but yeah, I
yes,
know what you meant.
you got me. Thank you. The point being, those books were written as fiction to bring up some points about historical fiction. I can certainly understand why a number of people who have those issues close to their heart and have experiences with boarding schools or relocation or not having sacred grounds honored feel very personal when they read stories like that, and it makes a connection to them that feels wrong. The way it was written, textbooks are written for, quite honestly, mostly people in California, Texas, and New York, because that's where 80% probably of the textbooks in the country are purchased. They weren't written for Alaska. And
okay.
So, I guess to answer your question, I don't believe that those books really were written for, intended for, or meet the needs of the students in Juneau or Alaska in general.
Okay. Has there been any communication with McGraw-Hill, the publisher, about this? And is there a possibility we can send them back?
Well, I'll let Ted answer that for a minute. First of all, let's be clear. This is a total – anybody could read these four pamphlets. They're really little paperback pamphlets in about an hour. So this is a very, very small portion of a very large curriculum. But as far as these four particular – I really would call them pamphlets more than books – are concerned, Ted has been in touch with them. They are a very small cost relative to the entire curriculum we purchased. But, Ted, would you like to speak to that?
We have made initial contact with the publisher, and they have not had an official response. Our liaison to the publisher expressed her desire that we would be able to have a communication about the books, but she wasn't able to commit anything on the publisher's behalf.
All right. Mark, you've been had a lot of experience in some diverse schools. Have you ever dealt with anything like this before?
Oh, I've dealt with a number of curriculum challenges based on what people feel is an insensitivity to a population or an issue. You know, when you teach, unfortunately, about the Civil War and slavery in a predominantly African-American culture, you always have people who have different views, different slants, believe it should be taught in a different way. That's what we do in public education. Everybody has different views. Not everybody wants their kid to learn everything in the same way, and so we do the best we can to hit the middle, fully understanding that in order to do that and educate the population, some people don't want their kids to learn some things or want them to learn things in a certain way. We have to listen to that and then make the right decisions.
And the Challenged Educational Resources Committee voted 7-2 on Friday to remove these. What comes next in the process for deciding what happens?
Yeah, that's why they call me superintendent.
you're the boss. You're in charge, yes.
So Ted was actually in charge of that committee and did an excellent job of facilitating it over two full days and got the recommendation. The recommendation, which is to remove the curriculum and have it replaced, is now on my desk. I'm reading it and reviewing it carefully, having some conversations with Ted to make sure I fully understand the recommendation. And then after Thanksgiving, when I take a few days off, I'm going to come back, and sometime next week I will make the decision and probably do so in a public forum.
Mark, this doesn't sound like, since these are just really small and you could read them in an hour, this can't have very much impact on the curriculum, does it?
It's not a huge, no. Overall, to the entire K-6 curriculum, the size of the impact is not huge. The impact on the community and the issues that it's brought up, I think, are huge. This could be a possibility where, for the first time ever, we talked to students about what boarding schools were like for people who were kind of made to go to them often or went there not totally along with their will. And there's still people alive who can share those experiences with us. So this has really opened up some opportunity for dialogue and instruction and place-based and culturally sensitive education that could really make Juneau, I think, a leader and a shining star as we start to move that direction.
Ted, you want to chime in on this?
One of the things that we had already done prior to the committee making its decisions, we did know that we wanted to have some other texts that would also tell the story so that teachers would have those resources as well. And so we've had another committee that has met once so far to look at what texts might be available that we could use in that part of the unit in fourth grade where these texts are from. And we've identified several potential texts, and we also know that we have local elders, and we have recordings of elders that can also be a resource. And so part of our work going forward is to align some of that work and some of those resources with both the reading curriculum and with our social studies curriculum.
So we really don't have a problem with filling a huge gap in, you know, a potential curriculum because of these four little issues.
Right. These books come from about a week's worth of the curriculum, and they're a small group. The intent is that in a student's textbook, they would do work around an entire story. And then when you go to your small group time, you'd use these texts to practice some foundational skills like author's purpose, setting, characters, thinking, and then practice rereading a text for different purposes. And so they're part of a small group study during about a week of time in the school year.
Mark, there really isn't a huge budget implication in the removal of these texts, is there?
No, there's not a huge budget implication. The cost to develop new material that we feel better fits and fits a need for our community and our school district is not huge. I think it's significant, but we're working with some of our partners who have grants and are interested in helping work with us on this issue to find some extra funding to develop the new materials, which we feel will be just a lot better and more effective.
But we can create this locally, right? We don't really have to go outside for a different source, do we?
Correct. We're looking at local people telling our local story to our local kids in a way that gets this message across.
Well, that really kind of customizes the curriculum to something that's definitely applicable here.
That's the plan.
Well, I didn't want to take your words out of your mouth there, Mark, but that sounds like that's the way to go from my perspective, and I just learned about it here in the last few days.
And without saying exactly what my decision is going to be, I think your insights are right on.
All right. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to add about the budget before I let you both go?
If anybody finds a really tough issue. Anyone finds a $2.5 million check laying around,
that would be fabulous.
We are down at the district office. We're on the corner of Glacier and 12th. Drop it off.
All right, Mark Miller and Ted Wilson, thank you very much for being our guests on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is BirdNote. More than a few birds take their names from the distinctive calls they make. And maybe the most vivid example is the call of the bobwhite. It's the only quail native to eastern North America. Officially known as the northern bobwhite, this chunky quail lives in brushy open country, grasslands, farmlands, and the edges of woods. Bobwhites are smartly feathered in rust and brown with bold face markings. Except during breeding season, bobwhites form coveys of up to 20 birds. They're one of the most economically important game birds in the U.S. But bobwhites are in trouble in most of their native range. Breaking habitat into smaller, separate pieces poses a major problem for the quail, as does the extensive use in farming of herbicides to control weeds. In addition, the birds are not adapted to the high density and close spacing of pine plantations. As a result, bobwhite numbers have plummeted. Like a number of other species of grasslands and open country, bobwhites will require more focused management of their habitat to meet the stiff conservation challenges they now face. Is there a bird or topic you would like to hear about on BirdNote? Give us a whistle. Or better yet, contact us at info@birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
A reminder to Capital Transit and Caravan passengers. Buses and vans will not be operating on Thursday, November 27th in recognition of the Thanksgiving Day holiday. Full service will resume on Friday, November 28th. The contact number for Capital Transit is 789-6901 and Caravan is 463-6194. This holiday season, consider giving the gift of transportation. Capital Transit bus passes provide unlimited rides for 1 month.
The Juno afternoon is just about over. It's 3:52 p.m., but my last guests here are Julie Jackson and Matt Lillard. Nice to see you both again from Eagle Crest. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, and you're here to talk about the Hillary Lynn Scholarship.
Yeah, so it's an annual scholarship competition. It is a competition. Every year we get one boy and one girl in grades K through 5 and one boy and one girl in grades 6 through 12. And the winners get selected to receive a season pass for Eagle Crest.
Okay, and let's talk a little bit about Hillary.
Hillary, she is infamous around town. She's awesome. So the competition was started, I think, back in 97 in her honor from, she's a silver medalist, World Cup champ. And the selection criteria is, one of them is competitive spirit, and she exemplifies that. So the students, when they apply for the scholarship, need to have something that exemplifies their competitive spirit and also academic achievement. And there's also a financial need component for the scholarship as well. So students seek out letters of reference and all sorts of documents to qualify. It's kind of a process, but deserving students get selected. It's pretty great.
And this is not the first year for this, is it?
No, it's been going on since, I believe it was 97 or 98 they started this. So it's been going on for quite a while. And it used to be just one boy and one girl in grades K through 12. But a few years ago, we wanted to add a couple more in there, and the board approved it. So now the Eagle Crest ski area donates 4 passes to this competition.
All right, Julie, I want to talk to Matt now. All right. Opening is supposed to be coming up on December 6th, Saturday. What is going on right now? We haven't been getting much snow, so tell me what the scoop is.
Yeah, so that's right. Our scheduled opening day is December 6th. At this point, I can't really say. Chances are not very good, but then again, you never know. We did pick up some snow yesterday. We've got 17 inches at the top of the mountain, but that dwindles pretty quickly as you drop down in elevation. That being said, we were able to make some snow in the Porcupine area when it was cold about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. And we're looking to turn the snowmaking guns on again late Thursday night, Friday morning, and keep making some snow in the Porcupine area. And that's an area that we can actually open with man-made snow. So that's our goal at this point while we wait for the natural snow to come, is to get open and be skiing on something.
Right. I'm going to get into the forecast after I'm done with you guys, but tomorrow night's supposed to go into lows 17 to 25 here. So
yeah, exactly. And up at the mountain, it'll obviously be even colder.
Of course.
We've got some really good temperatures, cold and dry. Is what you really want for snowmaking and our snowmaker crew.
It looks like you're going to get it.
Yeah, we're looking at 12 and 10 degrees, I think, at night, and a little bit warmer during the day. So we should be able to put out a bunch of snow, and we'll see what that brings. Sometimes they forecast these things to be a little short, and the high and dry stays around for a little bit longer. So as long as that's around, we're going to keep running around the clock with our snowmakers. We've got a couple of them were generous enough to volunteer to come in and work late on the night of Thanksgiving, so that shift will start at midnight on Thursday night, and we're going to go 24 hours around the clock and put out as much snow as we possibly can.
Matt, how's the construction coming on the Porcupine Lodge? I know I've been able to see it on the website, but where exactly are we at? The last thing I saw was the siding was going on.
they're all inside now and cranking away at sheetrocking and electric, running all the electric and those sorts of things. So as of right now, we're tentatively scheduled to be able to occupy the building on December 18th, which is right before our big holiday stretch. So if that holds true, we're going to try to move a bunch of the operations in there for the holiday stretch. But with anything construction-wise, it's always kind of a moving timeline. And with every passing week, we get a better idea of what's going to happen. But at this point, the best we can do is try to push the construction crew as best we can and hope they get us in there before the holidays.
Okay, so the delay probably wasn't because of the snow, which we haven't had. Did they give you any reason why we're kind of backed up?
Yeah, there's no specific one thing that's really held us up. It's a couple small things here and there. And I think, this is my first venture into a big construction project like this. And as we've seen around town with other projects, things can just get held up for any number of reasons. Obviously, getting things to Juneau via barge or otherwise can slow things down. And with a project this size on such a short timeline, these things just happen. So we're really just we're crossing our fingers, hoping we can get in. Obviously, we're open starting December 18th, every day but Christmas, all the way through to January 5th. So it's a long run, and obviously schools are out, and a lot of people want to be up there, and we'd love to have that facility available. We just have to wait and see.
All right, Julie, and let's let everybody know the website address again where they can find the link to click in about scholarship information.
Yeah, so if you go to skijuno.com, they'll also be the posts on Facebook. So the applications are there for download. You can also pick them up from any Juno school around town, and they can be mailed in or dropped off to any Juno public school. So I'll be running around on the due date, which is Thursday, December 4th, and picking those up.
All right. Matt, anything else you wanted to add today?
No, just everybody keep thinking snow and cold. And while we haven't had a whole lot of cold weather yet, it can change in a heartbeat. And I know we're all anxiously looking at the forecast on a daily basis. And we'll take the cold weather now. And hopefully when this high and dry period ends, it'll come in with some moisture and drop a bunch of snow on us.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about lift tickets and season passes.
Yeah, so our main season's pass season, sales season, has basically come to an end, and we had a really good season, and we got a lot of people signed up for season passes, which is always a good sign for the season. You can still purchase them if you haven't already at skijuno.com or come on up to the base lodge. We're open Thursday through Monday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then on a lift ticket standpoint, this year's lift tickets are $46 for adults for an all-day lift ticket, so it's still a great deal, and then as you go younger, the rates go down as well. And there's also lots of other deals out there if you want to learn to ski. There's beginner packages through the Snow Sports School. So we just encourage people to check out skijuno.com. It's got all the information you need to know about Eagle Crest.
Okay, Matt and Julie, thank you very much for being our guests on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and now let's get to the forecast because I gave a little bit of a peek of that. Tonight's supposed to be decreasing clouds with isolated rain showers in the evening and some patchy fog late. Lows in the 30s and light winds becoming northeasterly at 10 miles an hour. Tomorrow is locally windy and sunny. Wow, it'd be nice to see that with highs in the mid-30s to 40. Warmest near downtown Juneau and Douglas and northeast winds at 10 miles an hour. Tomorrow night, mostly clear, windy, and colder with lows in the upper teens to mid-20s and northeast winds at 30 miles an hour with locally higher gusts possible. Well, that sounds like there's your snowmaking opportunity right there, at least a good one. This is KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast on 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also broadcast on the following translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay, you can tune to K276 AF 103.1. Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listeners, K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Straight, you can get KTOO on 210 AS 89.9. And you can also get KTOO on GCI Cable Digital Channel 871. Everybody have a safe and happy holiday. For those of you shopping tomorrow or on Thursday and Friday, be courteous and patient. I'll see you next week.
How do you move forward from this? I'm just, besides being so sad,